welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducciu. And you get Jem to kick things off again, because I have been talking to somebody on Twitter, Greg. We always encourage people to sort of reach out. And this was actually an example of somebody who corrected me. I've been talking to them about all kinds of things. She's really interesting. Do you know what? I'm thinking maybe we should get her on the podcast at some point. I know she's also a regular listener. I'm going to use her by her Twitter handle. This is at Anna Proofing. She's a proofreader and editor, as well as writer and lover of history and busy woman in general, but she came up with a great one, which, do you know what, I think I'd never come up with it in a million years, but it's like, oh yeah, that's a really good topic. And she said, well, what about revolutionary music or musicians that changed the world? And I think in general, as soon as you start thinking about that, you almost naturally fall into the latter half of the 20th century. But I would argue that that's generally because we tend to think that because classical music is now associated with being very part of the establishment, it's very classy, it's very safe, it's what rich people like, that those people never took any risks. None of those people ever behaved badly. But actually, they did. That's not to say we're not going to talk about the 20th century, but I think that in a way, almost all music, in a very strange way, tends to be a little bit subversive. Your thoughts, Greg?
I think to say that all music is subversive is possibly overstretching the argument. Yeah. But there is obviously an idea of subversive music. Well, the thing about music is that it does this incredible thing. It taps into rhythms, and it's something that it's not very easy to argue your case about. We all like different types of music. Everyone sort of has different types of music they like. And whereas when we've talked about the history of comedy, we can sit here and we can have a discussion, or when we talked about sort of silent movies and things, we can sit here and have a discussion and say, well, I like this about this and I like this about this. And you can do that to a certain extent with music. But also, to a certain extent, music is, it kind of picks people up, it grabs them, it moves them along, and it does very much live in its time. And it's also something that changes, and people want to have their own music. It's, I think, more than anything else, is something, especially, you know, I'm going back to sort of school and things, but even now, it is a question that gets asked, oh, what sort of music are you into? And it is something that's used to judge people a lot. A lot of people, you find out what sort of music people listen to. And like you say, if you hear somebody say, oh, I listen to an awful lot of classical music, that's my thing, you might form an opinion of them as being, you know, quite a calm person, possibly quite an elite person, something like that. If somebody says they're into, I don't know, heavy metal music or something, that's going to give you a very, very different impression of the person. In the way that I think the books you read or the TV programs you watch, I think they're much more general. I think you get less of that sort of immediate judging of people. So I think in that way, some music is obviously designed to fit in. It is designed to be middle of the road. You know, we have that phrase for music. You have music that's actually designed to fit in. But as you say, there's also throughout history, there's always going to be people that want their own music, who have something different to say, something controversial to say. And music has, through the ages, been an interesting way of doing that, because when you're dealing with societies and cultures where you're not allowed to speak out, when you can get in trouble if you say something wrong, then actually controversial music is very, very hard to police. And I'm sure we're going to get into how it has been policed in the past. But just music, just the sounds of notes, that's quite hard to define what's good and what's evil about a piece of music if you're trying to outlaw something.
Yes, but what you've done in my head, as happens to both of us, is I was planning on going in one direction, but I have to absolutely pause and do something I wasn't planning on doing, because you were talking about you know, how people ask you about your type of music. And what I find interesting, during my day job, I deal with people who are my age, perhaps slightly older than me, and then I also deal with graduates. You know, some of these people were born in 1996, which is slightly depressing from my perspective, but from their point of view, that was the year that they were born, okay? And what I find interesting is, Obviously, there are huge amounts of difference between me and a 21-year-old. But if I ask them, oh, have you been watching this TV series on Netflix? Yes, yes. You know, we're both watching the same TV series. We're both watching the same films that are coming out at the moment. And when I say, oh, you know, have you seen the classics like The Godfather? Most people say yes. Some say no, but I'm planning on watching that film. But then you come to music. And then they go, oh, have you been listening to this? It's like, no, I haven't. And you realize that basically your musical fashions and tastes evolve as you grow up, but they kind of stop. They kind of solidify once you have children. And this is what happened to my parents, and this is what's happened to me. And I'm sure there'll be a few people go, well, that's not my case. I'm still listening to the latest whatever. Great, good for you. But you have to recognize that most people, their lives are so full once you have kids and you start worrying about careers that you don't have time to reach out for new music. And I actually said to this one girl, I made a passing comment to this one girl saying, I've never heard anything by Taylor Swift. And she was mortified. She was a huge Taylor Swift fan. She goes, oh, no, you've got to listen to something. During one of our breaks, you have to listen to some Taylor Swift. And she, you know, stuck her headphones into my ears and went, oh, what do you think of this song? No idea what it is. Can't tell you what it was. But I listened to it and it was well-polished pop. You know, it was, should we say, something like Duran Duran from the 80s or ABBA from the 70s. It was clearly well-honed, well-put-together pop. And I said, yeah, it's good. And she goes, what do you mean it's good? It's great. It's amazing. I went, yes, but I'm not the target demographic. I think that Taylor Swift would be appalled if there was a 44-year-old man going, I love her. She's great. She's the best musician ever. But if you're a 21-year-old girl, that makes sense. And there's nothing wrong with that. I also hate the argument about when's the best period to be alive for music, because the answer is easy and obvious. It's today. Because today I can listen to Mozart or Motorhead or Katy Perry. I can listen to Eminem or Black Sabbath. It doesn't matter. I can, whatever type of music I like, I am spoilt for choice as of today.
And I think that the important thing that sort of changed music, and we're going to get back onto the original topic you put on, but I think one of the most important things that changed music in that way was the, and I'm going to use a brand name here because I'm sure it wasn't the very first, but I think it's by far and away the one that changed, is the Walkman. The Sony Walkman. The first time, really, that you could put music in your own ears and other people couldn't hear it. That was the first. Before that, you know, if people were playing music, one, you had most of your music came over the radio or records. Record players, quite a big bulky thing. You'd play your music and other people would hear it. Your parents would hear it, or, you know, just commuters. You couldn't sit there as a commuter and listen to your own music privately. Now you sit on a train or a bus or anything else, everybody has their own music. You know, people can put their own music in their ears and just listen to what they want to be doing.
Or they might be listening to this podcast, of course.
Or they might be listening to this podcast. Yeah, if you are, thank you so much. But these days, music does go straight into your ears, and there is no possible way. Same problem we have with the internet, but also same wonder we have the internet. It's very, very difficult to police what people are listening to nowadays. And so, even more than ever, I think, subversive music, or, you know, just music that is outside of the mainstream, gets more of a chance to be heard because it doesn't need major radio play. Same as our podcast, really. We don't have to be on a major radio station to put our voices across. Everything goes out there and people can individually choose to listen to different sounds. But I know that's not what you actually wanted to talk about today, Jim.
No, I've got... look, if we don't mention Mozart and Beethoven, and this is about music, I think we're doing it wrong, quite frankly.
Yeah.
So out of curiosity, Greg, do you know at what age Mozart started composing music?
I believe, and this is fairly random, I don't know why this number immediately lumped in my head, I believe 5.
Spot on, sir.
Oh, watch 5, yes.
How about that for an overachiever? Okay, second question. Look, you already get the points. The points are in the bank here, Greg. But, you know, for a bonus amount of sort of proving how awesome you are, do you know how old he was when he died?
Oh, that I don't. I'm going to say 30s, but I could be. I don't feel as confident on
that.
Go on,
pick a number in the 30s.
Oh, okay. 38.
35. But come on, guys. You know, I'll never forget the time when Greg did the opening on the stuff about Oliver Cromwell going, I've asked my mother-in-law about him. You know, so that told me how much research you'd done on that one. But Greg clearly knows his stuff when it comes to music. But, you know, Mozart is, you know, he was revolutionary. He was a little bit dangerous. You know, there were elements of his works that were revolutionary, and people generally didn't necessarily like revolutionary. And also, he went as a child, he was toured around so many different countries, so many royal courts, as almost like a freak. You know, look at this 6-year-old who can play the piano. Look at this 8-year-old who is, you know, competently composing music. Just, that's absolutely remarkable. And therefore, because he was so, it was almost like he was born of music, that he could get away with things. And actually, the way where me and Anna Proofing first started talking about this is she made the valid comment about, we tend to think of operas as being very boring and staid and in their ways. And again, sort of classical music, it's safe, isn't it? It's just nice music. It's not trying to say anything or do anything. But The Marriage of Figaro was very subversive of the time, because it's about the working class people sort of kicking up. I know that's a phrase that you like there, Greg, and how they kind of get the upper hand on the aristocracy. Now, when you consider that this is being written in the late 1700s, the aristocracy was still very much there. Indeed, you could almost argue that, you know, this is all sort of like coming out, you know, just sort of shortly before the French Revolution, and it might in theory have been one of the favourite operas of the revolutionaries, because it is that working class people getting an advantage, getting one up on the landed gentry. So dangerous. And if, you know, certainly if it had been taken the wrong way, sort of thing he could have been locked up for. I mean, after all, Galileo was locked up for less. So, you know, I think that's just an example of Mozart. We could do an entire, you know, one on him, but we need sort of crack on, as it were. Do you have any other thoughts on Mr. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart?
I can't say I have any particular thoughts on Mr. I'm just pleased that I got the ages. So
yeah, you're
close.
Just sitting there still basking in the glow of victory.
That's it. I mean, when you talked about the research that we've done for this particular podcast, I did, you know, obviously use my old-fashioned research technique. Just before we go on, just to let you behind the curtain a little bit, you know, I usually do a little bit of reading beforehand for these. Then just before we start the podcast each week, I open up a raft of different tabs on my computer with different things that I've researched during the week, so I can hop backwards and forwards to remind myself of dates and things like that. And I popped on the computer to start this episode. I typed in the word music, and the autofill took me straight to looking at all of the music hall flatulence performers that we were talking about.
Excellent.
On the podcast a few weeks ago. That apparently
Excellent.
Is now my top search for music. So, okay, so we'll move on slightly from Mozart, because one of the things that immediately jumped into my head when you started talking about music and the way music can be particularly transgressive was that I remembered hearing a long time ago all about the Devil's Chord.
Go on.
Devil's Tritone. Now, this is one of those things I've heard about, and basically the Devil's Tritone, it is, for those people who are musically minded, apparently the diminished fifth. For anything that means anyone that means something to. But basically it's a tritone, which means it's three notes played at once as a chord. And it has a real sound to it. It has a real slightly creepy, slightly powerful sound to it. And the rumours go, you can search all around this, and I'd always heard that it was banned and people could be executed for using the Devil's Tritone in a piece of music and all of this. And I've actually done some digging to try and find out if there is any truth at all in the rumour that this was actually out and out banned from the church. And the answer is no, there's not actually, that I can find. And I hope somebody corrects me and there is more to this than just rumour. But the fact of the matter is that what the church did do was they declared way back in about the 9th century we have it being suggested that this particular musical chord just technically doesn't work and therefore shouldn't be used when writing religious music. And because of that, we kind of get this one chilling sound that kind of gets left out of, especially as sort of the Christian music, the religious music, was what was being pushed around that sort of time. And throughout history, even if we talk about Christmas carols today, or we talk about music that everyone knows, Christmas carols, we get to Christmas, I would say probably some of the most recognisable songs in Britain would be Christmas carols. You could probably get yep. more people singing the words to those, even if you don't believe in the religion behind it. There's a fantastic line, speaking of transgressive musicians, there's a wonderful line in one of the Tim Minchin songs, all about Christmas, where he says about some of the tunes being quite nice, but the lyrics are dodgy when he talks about Christmas carols. And so Christian music is what filters out and becomes the sort of base level normal for music. So when you have chords and things that are specifically not used, deliberately left out of that music, then people can start to use those deliberately and just have a sound that immediately suggests evil, suggests, you know, sort of fear or whatever. And part of that, I believe, interestingly, just to flick a bit around, I'm going to have one more point here, Jim, then I'll get back to you talking, because I believe I've been rambling for a while. One little point that kind of makes that sensible to me, the idea that it's the way we lay things out, is there are some parts in the world, in this country, if you hear something played in a major key, it sounds happy, it sounds nice, it sounds warm. We're used to that. When people play things in a minor key, that's where it sounds more moody, it sounds darker, it sounds, you know, it's just not got that lightness to it. But there are parts in the world where that is actually completely reversed. And it's just because, even though we talk about our musical taste changing, you've talked about the fact that, you know, you listening to Taylor Swift, you can say that's a nice piece of music, but it's not for you. Despite that, our basic groundwork in our culture, in the Western world, in any particular culture, your basic groundwork of music is all the same. You're building off, you're working off each other, because we have a way of listening to music that tells us things, you know, sort of ever since we were a child, we listened to music, and that's told us that major chords, major keys, they're bright, they're warm, minor keys are not. And I just find it fascinating that that's not an innate thing. That's not something that's just a natural thing in humanity. It is a cultural thing that's been built on. And so when we're talking about writing music that steps out of the mainstream, it can just be a chord that Christian music shunned because it was technically not working, and that became then built up into this whole idea of a devil's chord.
Okay, I see your devil's chord, and I raise you Alexander Scriabin.
Well, I take your Alexander Scriabin, and I raise you Alice Jones. Are we just saying random things now?
So, Alexander Nikolaevich Scriabin, I had to do some research into him. I'd heard a passing comment about him, went, that can't be true, but it turns out it is. So, you know, if the fact that his middle name is Nikolaevich, I think you can work out he's Russian, born in the 1800s. So, Russian composer, 1800s. This is all sounding good, isn't it? You know, this is a Tchaikovsky or something like that, right? Now, he is a well-respected composer, and he actually spent quite a lot of time trying to blend the different senses. There is actually a form of there is a condition where actually you hear sounds as colours. And he didn't seem to have it, but he loved the idea of associating notes with certain colours. So while you're playing his music, you're also literally painting a picture as well. What a brilliant idea. Very revolutionary. And he also wanted to sort of incorporate smell as well. I wonder what C sharp smells like. You know, maybe it's a bit like blueberries. Who knows? But you know, this idea of creating, overwhelming your senses with the experience of his music, this is all pretty cool. However, Scriabin was also an occultist, and he wrote one piece of work, which one of his symphonies is referred to as the Black Mass. That's in theory not its official name, but that was clearly what he was going for. But none of that, absolutely none of that, compares to his masterpiece called Mysterium. Now, he started composing it in 1903, and it was unfinished when he died in 1915. He was about, I don't know, sort of in his 40s when he died. He actually died relatively young. But the thing about Mysterium was the idea was he wanted to create, I promise you I'm not making this up. You will think this is madness, but anyway. He wanted to create a week-long event in the foothills of the Himalayas where he played the entire of Magisterium, Mysterium, apologies. And to give you an idea, because it was incomplete, somebody has managed to piece together his notes. And the prelude, you know, that opening overture that you get if you're going to a musical or something, the opening overture is like a couple of minutes long and it's a couple of notes of some of the songs you're going to hear later on. Yes, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and it's sort of 2-3 minutes long. Here are the greatest hits you're going to hear. The overture for this thing, and that's the only thing we've got, is 3 hours long, okay? So he was really building up to something, and what he was building up to is he genuinely thought that if he could get the key people there in the foothills of the Himalayas for a week and they played Mysterium, it would end the world. So if we're going to talk about controversial revolutionary music, beat that. You know, people thought that Elvis was the sound of the devil. He was just having a good time. This Russian composer, Scriabin, genuinely wanted to end the world with his music.
Well, I think that I can't top that. Really, what you've done is I had another thing I was going to talk about, and you kind of undermined.
Kind of crushed that, haven't I? Okay, sorry.
You should have gone asked. Well, the only piece of music that I had left to go on that I actually made a note to write down was actually because I had a recent experience related to it, and that is we've kind of left really, for the most part, recent history alone. But one of the things about music does draw people together. And that's all fine and happy when people go along with it. But I want to talk about you because I live down here on the Isle of Wight, Jim.
Yep.
I couldn't leave a discussion of music like this passed up without mentioning the Isle of Wight Festival.
Yes, and okay.
I'm well aware that there is an Isle of Wight Festival today. I've never been. I have no interest in going. Every year I look at the lineup of the bands and I think, I don't know most of those people.
It's only going to get worse, Greg.
I don't have any particular interest in the music that's being played. And also, I just don't have any particular interest in that festival. It's not for me. However, a few weeks ago, I was asked to help out a friend of mine who's with a band. And I won't go into any details here because he's not given me permission to talk about any of this. But he was working on a new song. And I was helping him do a little bit of filming. And as part of that, I got the opportunity to go and stand up on a hill near us. And it's one that normally it doesn't actually have public access to it. But if you stand on top of that hill, you can look out across the ground that was the location of the famous 1970 Isle of Wight Festival, which for those people who don't know, those people who don't know, and because we've pointed out not everyone knows everything about music, anyone who knows the name Jimi Hendrix, if you know the name Jimi Hendrix, you heard the Isle of Wight Festival, this was actually his last festival performance, but this was a huge festival. It actually only ran for about 3 years. A lot of people that know the Isle of Wight Festival runs today think it has been running all of that time. It didn't. It ran back in the 70s. It was an entirely different location from where the festival is today. And you stand up on that hill now and you look out across this peaceful, untouched, beautiful countryside and you try and picture hundreds of thousands of people there all joined together just to listen to music, to sing, to have a good time. And the fact of the matter, the reason it didn't actually carry on for all that time was it was banned. They stopped letting them hold the festival here at that time because it was considered far too dangerous. We're talking about in the 1970s. It wasn't, you know, it was a culture based around music that worried people, worried certainly sort of the council, the people who actually banned it. And we see this across the world, music festivals, music concerts being banned. And it's the music that is drawing people in. And the fact that even sort of the 70s, and I'm sure people have more recent examples of musical events that have been banned purely because of the, purely because they are gatherings for music. And I find it fascinating that music has that much power that even, you know, there was no major political aspect to this. There was no, you know, this wasn't like some sort of political gathering, some political campaign. This was a music festival and it got banned because people were worried about the influence and the effect that the music could have.
A quick follow-up on that. I know I've mentioned this before, but I always found this interesting because, yes, you're quite right. It's legendary. It's Jimi Hendrix's legendary last ever live performance. But actually, if you listen to the diaries, and actually you can see some of the footage, it wasn't very good. And Hendrix himself was very frustrated with it. There was poor sound mixing. He could barely hear himself singing. It wasn't good. And because he died shortly after it, there's far more importance put on it than there should be. I'm pretty sure as far as Hendrix was concerned, don't listen to that. That's not the best I can do. But that's not the way it's now been remembered. It is almost mythical. Talking recently about cowboys, another bit of mythicalness. Anyway, but it is interesting that some music is considered dangerous, revolutionary almost. And music seems to have more passion than perhaps art. I'm not saying that there isn't revolutionary art or indeed works of fiction, books that have been banned, etc. But music is more immediate. You know, if I play a tune that you really like, your foot will start tapping. You'll want to get up and dance. It's not quite the same thing if you're reading a book. It may be a brilliant, brilliant book. You may love this book, but it doesn't suddenly compel you to get up and move around. But that's what music does. And the suggestion is because music has such a powerful impact on us as people, it must have been the first art form that we came up with. And indeed, sort of like banging logs rhythmically with a stick was probably our first form of music. And, you know, that sort of tribal noises, perhaps that beat being at about the same speed as our heartbeat, which is generally what dance music is at. Therefore, it gets you excited, and it could therefore be dangerous if it's sort of being said or done in the wrong way. I did say we needed to mention Beethoven. You know, the story about a man who was slowly going deaf, creating some of the most beautiful music ever. That's all been done by other people and better than us. But the thing I wanted to do was talk very briefly about his Symphony Number 3, known as Eroica. And what's interesting about that is originally it was dedicated to Napoleon. He was writing it at the same time as Napoleon was having his sort of early successes. He'd just come back from the Middle East. And what's interesting is we have his original notes and we can see he scratched through. There's actually a hole in the page. He sort of furiously scribbled out Napoleon's name. And apparently that was at the point when Napoleon crowned himself emperor. A lot of people in Europe were hoping that Napoleon could be this powerful general sort of born of the revolution who could perhaps bring more social justice or something like that. But as soon as the facade slipped instantaneously when he wanted to become an emperor, and everybody who had been his defender outside of France suddenly went, oh no, he's the same as everybody else. And so this piece got renamed. But what's interesting about that is you get a bit of military history, political history in a piece of music being written, which you wouldn't necessarily think of when you think of somebody like Beethoven.
No, you wouldn't think of Beethoven, but of course music and politics goes hand in hand far more than any of us would really want. It is, there are whole musical, and you know, which musician you can have backing certain campaigns and whose music you use in campaigns matters even today. But one of the most basic use of political music is with the idea of a national anthem. And I know that not every single country in the world has a national anthem, but I believe it's almost every single one. And these pieces of music are held up, obviously in Britain, held up to ridicule, because that's what we kind of do with everything British. We like to have a bit of fun at its expense. But the importance of national anthem and having music that brings people together is very clear. The fact that, as we've already discussed, music and religion and music in politics, but just the fact that music matters and our national anthem, even, or national anthem in general, is so important. You get situations where, obviously, the German national anthem, the verse that used to be sung during the Second World War as the main anthem, has now been dropped from the German national anthem. And in fact, a few years ago, there was a question about exactly how their law can be read, and it may actually be completely illegal to sing that verse. It may be considered defamation of their national anthem. And, you know, that's a huge scale. That's a hugely important thing about that piece of music. But then, even recently, in recent British politics, I know Jeremy Corbyn got called up for not singing along to the national anthem. And, you know, my politics is out there that I don't like any of them. So I think I'm fairly safe to say. But the fact of the matter is, rightly or wrongly, it became this huge question about whether or not somebody is going to sing the words to a song that everybody joins in on. And it was one of those weird things when I used to do my show, Condensed History of Britain, History of Britain in 90 Minutes. I used to have this wonderful moment where I used to play the national anthem as part of that show. And it was fascinating in different situations to see the way people would react to a piece of music played out strongly, and the fact that if people treated that music with respect and decided to stand up, the audience would all stand up to that singular piece of music. Whereas if nobody started standing up, then nobody would stand up. But as soon as that music is given power, as soon as that music is given impact, I never had to explain what it was. I never had to tell people what that piece of music was. I could just play a very, very short snatch of music and a whole room of people decides on their actions based on their reaction to what this tiny piece of music actually fundamentally means to them. And I think that that is why music is so important, because a short snatch of it can have so much weight behind it. And I think, Jim, that that is all I've really got on the subject of music at this point in time.
Well, you've stimulated me that I wasn't planning on doing this, but I've got to throw this in right now and then I'm done. But you made the mention of God Save the Queen or God Save the King, depending on who's in charge. But the interesting thing about that national anthem, it is the English national anthem, so British, allegedly. Anyway, it's the tune has been around for quite a long time. I'm not sure if it's the first national anthem, but the point is it was one of the first, and it was ours at the time of a massive empire, and therefore lots of countries use the same tune. Sometimes they've been pushed out, you know, you're unlikely to hear it now as the official national anthem, but there is usually, quite often, there are an unusual amount of variations, and my favourite one is the American one, because I was sitting there with some members of the family, and suddenly I hear, you know, the American president, they suddenly strike up the English national anthem. It's like, what are you doing? Surely it's the Star Spangled Banner. And in America, it's called My Country Tis of Thee. Now, I cannot sing, but here it is, sort of fairly tunelessly, the first verse. My country tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrims' pride, from every mountainside let freedom ring. I think we can do them for copyright infringement, surely. Anyway, but yes, if you actually sort of kick around, you'll find out that actually the God Save the Queen King theme crops up in some surprising places. You would have thought the Americans, for starters, would not want to have anything to do with the, you know, the British national anthem. But anyway, there we go. I'm done. Let's go to plugs.
Just before we go to plugs, because you mentioned, you know, the copyright infringement of our national anthem. Just purely out of interest, do you know the authorised first verse of the British national anthem?
Okay, clearly I don't. Go on then.
Well, actually, there is none. We don't. The Buckingham Palace, because there was a bit of controversy a few years ago, there is the verse about the rebellious Scots. which sometimes gets referred to as a second verse, third verse, fourth verse, or whatever, was briefly sung by some people.
That was briefly sung during the revolt of 1745. And the Scots can get... I've had this hammered at me by so many Scots. It's like, well, if you actually look at the history, it was never official. It was there for about a year, and it was brought up because you guys invaded England, okay? We're allowed to get angry about that. I'm sorry. And it's not a part of the official national anthem, and I don't think it's ever been. If it was, it hasn't been for like 200 years, so get over it. Anyway.
The actual point, before we went on that little lovely side rant, I did enjoy that.
Thank you.
The actual point I was going to make about the whole thing, which you can actually point out to people in future, is there is no official authorised national anthem. Buckingham Palace, the royal family, they have never actually approved a national anthem. The actual official line from the official website of the British monarchy does clearly state there is no authorised version of the national anthem, as the words are a matter of tradition. We do not actually have, technically speaking, an authorised national anthem. So we've
great,
bounced
great
around music
final
there.
Quote. The great final fact, I should say. Well done, Greg.
I find that one fascinating. So we bounced around music, but Jem, music to my ears, what would you like to plug today?
Okay, I am going to plug, because I'm hoping this comes out before Christmas. Come on, guys, get me a Christmas present. Get your friends a Christmas present, which is Silent Crossroads, my first self-published historical novel. It's World War One. It's World War Two. It's about a soldier who decides to change sides in the middle of a world war. There's love. There's family drama. There's action. There's even some Christmas scenes in it. There's zero singing, which is hard to do in a book, I suppose. So, yes, there we go. Please give it a go. Silent Crossroads. It's on Amazon. The pile of very positive reviews is growing. Check it out.
And I just want to do a quick shout out again for The Last Airship, my steampunk web series. Go to www.thelastairship.com. That will take you straight to the first episode. The first episode is 6 minutes long. Go ahead, give it a watch. If you enjoy it on YouTube, please leave a little comment underneath. Give it a thumbs up. And because we've been talking about music, I'll also add a shout out in that the first episode, and actually a lot of the series, the title track, is all played by the wonderful band Kiss Like Ether, a fantastic steampunk band. And actually, we've been talking today about the importance of music. If you go over and watch the first episode of The Last Airship and just listen to the music, the one song that is used throughout that episode, it was hearing that song that inspired The Last Airship and really took up an entire year of my life working on the web series. So that is the power of listening to a single piece of music on a personal level for me. And thank you all very, very much for listening to the podcast. As always, we like to do a little bit of a plug on the end for the whole podcast. So please share, please go and tell your friends about this podcast. We really, really do appreciate it. And a massive thank you to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducci.
And a wonderful, wonderful co-host of mine, Greg Chapman.
And we will see you next week. And don't forget, we do have our Fast Five episode every Friday. But for now, goodbye and take care.